how did they form in 1955? What gave these lesbians the idea in San Francisco that this was just the right political moment in history to sit down and organize? Well, here's another whiteout, whitewash from the official histories. The decade of militant red feminism from 1946 to the mid-50s, in which communist women, black and white, were out organizing, particularly in strength, on the West Coast in California. And they also helped lay a theoretical basis for the relationship of women's oppression to racism and to class oppression, and to fight for an understanding within the left movement that women's oppression is a critical frontline battle in the class war. And in 1955, that was the year that the civil rights movement accelerated. In the summer of 1955, before the Daughters of Bilitis formed, you could see black women, particularly working class women, in the leadership of a movement that was inspiring the downtrodden everywhere in the US and around the world. That was the summer that 14-year-old Emmett Till was dragged from the bed where he was visiting in Mississippi and lynched, the third lynching of an African-American male in the US that year alone. His mother, Mamie Till Mobley, made a courageous decision in Chicago. She demanded that the casket be opened for his funeral. And 50,000 people lined the streets of Chicago to view his body, which was almost unrecognizable because of the mutilation by white supremacists. 100 days later, seamstress Rosa Parks refused to surrender her seat on a municipal bus in Birmingham to a white man who demanded it. She later told a reporter, "I kept thinking about Emmett Till. I couldn't get the photos out of my mind." After a 381-day bus boycott, it was like it lit the tinder of all the anti-lynching and all the anti-racist, anti-Jim Crow segregation organizing that was going on. After 381 days in which 40,000 African Americans refused to take the bus and walk to work, that hard-won battle just sent shockwaves through the country in terms of inspiring people that oppression could be fought. Lesbians and gay men of all nationalities, including whites, were part of the civil rights movement, supporting not just an end to racist apartheid, to segregation, but the aspirations and the ongoing struggle for national liberation, because the U.S. is like a prison house of nations. It's like domestic colonies, internal colonies under police occupation. And when the FBI tried to bust up the movement, to fracture the solidarity and break it up, they didn't just use red baiting, they used gay baiting. When I said that the homophile movement did not defend those of us who were in the bars, did not want to be associated with those of us in the bars, I'm not just criticizing like a Monday morning quarterback. It's the reason that Stonewall exploded. Those from below were nose to nose with the state. We knew at any moment in the bars that the cops could come through the door at any time. And just to get a job, just to get an apartment, just to use the toilet in public, just to walk down the street was a battle. It was no accident that Stonewall exploded from those who were the most oppressed. Stonewall was mostly fueled, that uprising, by those youth who lived in the little vest pocket park across the street, who could not afford to get into the bar with those watered down expensive drinks. They were black youth, Latina youth, white youth. They were homeless. Many were sex workers. They pooled their money just to be able to have one hotel room that they could share. And when the police raided that night and the government agents were there demanding the draft cards of everyone and dunking the heads of the drag queens into buckets of water and smearing the makeup on their faces and mocking them as limp-wristed sissies and reminding them that the sentence would be carried out that night in the backseat of a police cruiser or on the cold cement floor of a precinct cell. Those who were being rounded up struggled and fought back, and so did the youth in the street. And they surrounded the police and they began to throw their precious pocket change and pebbles and bottle caps and anything they could find. And the police began to retreat, not just because of a hail of tiny projectiles, but the youth that night taught the police that a stiletto high heel in the hands of an enraged transgender youth is a formidable weapon against police brutality. And where did the youth get inspired that night? The battles that were going on all over the city, all over the country. Black power, the American Indian movement, the organizing of the Chicano farm workers in the fields, the young lords who were the Puerto Rican revolutionary youth, the militant Asian youth, students, the anti-Vietnam War movement, and women's liberation. That night, the youth were so ferocious that the police actually retreated back in the Stonewall Bar and barricaded themselves inside, and someone had the foresight to cut the electric and power lines and phone lines so they were in there in the dark without backup. And this crowd, these were people whose bodies still bore the wounds from their arrests, who knew their oppressors by name and by face, and they rocked a parking meter and uprooted it from a concrete sidewalk to use as a battering ram to get in that bar at those police. They used lighter fluid and tried to burn the damn bar down. There were struggles going on in that city for open admissions at the school. The Columbia University had displaced people of Harlem, set up an apartheid fence around the school to keep it all lily white. And the students carried out an armed occupation. Students of many nationalities took over the campus and opened it up and called it Harlem U and said, everybody's coming to school for free now. Now the schools in the U.S. are being resegregated, not by grade point average, but by the elimination of financial aid and by hiking up soaring tuition costs to the point where nobody can afford it. But those were the struggles that won women's studies, that won Black and Chicano studies, that won Native studies. Those weren't gifts from the university administration. They were hard won from the movement from below. When women's liberation began to really take off, people like myself were not welcomed by many in the women's movement. And again, I don't say this to tear down the women's movement, but to make it stronger today. Movements are like the individuals, those of us who make up movements. We make mistakes. We only know what we know. When it's not conscious, it's still unconscious. There are a lot of currents in a movement. It's like a white-capped river. And which current is in the ascendancy, which current has the power and the forward thrust, will determine the politics of that movement. I want to raise one lesson that I think is applicable today. And that was not anything that those in the women's movement at the time did to be cruel or vicious or anything else. It was just the opposite. It was an important social experiment. Because women's liberation for the first time was, first of all, creating the word woman with pride. I mean, all the words that I grew up with, for those of us who were female, were not words that we would want to use about ourselves. But it also was a movement that showed the different socialization of those who were born female and male. And that was an important contribution because people did not even admit that women were oppressed. It's like, oh, honey, why? Because some guy opens a door for you, big deal. There was a ridiculing of the institutionalization of oppression and the way the economy profited from it and the way it pitted people against each other. And also, the women's movement, and again, I'm speaking in a general way when I say the women's movement, but those of us who have been in late night meetings hammering out the language on press releases know that movements don't speak with one voice. But this was a widespread attempt to show how steeped concepts of femininity and masculinity were in poisonous attitudes. And that was a contribution too. But the solution that many tried, and it was a significant social experiment to try, was to see could humankind, not just women, but humankind be liberated by suppressing or doing away with femininity and masculinity and creating a kind of androgyny that would liberate people from the poisonous concepts that were so imbued in these gender expressions. Now, first of all, those of us who were butch were considered to be part of the patriarchy. And those who loved us were considered to be have no consciousness and be sleeping with the enemy. It was a vulgarization, but again, like I said, what we don't know, we don't know. And what is not conscious yet is still unconscious. And you know, androgyny is very liberating if you are androgynous. But if those of us who had been gang raped and beaten and institutionalized and humiliated and hounded and harassed and could not find a job and could not get medical care and were not safe walking down the street, did not change our gender expression, why would we? Because people in the movement said the way we were wasn't right. We wanted a movement that didn't just tolerate us, but needed us. And the movement did need us. And that's an important thing to remember. I believe that there are two very important tasks that still need to be done from that experiment. And one is to defend everybody's right to freedom of gender expression without criticism, without judgment, because it is not my tie that is oppressing you. It is not your wingtip rogues or your lipstick that is oppressing me. Part of the gift of second wave women's liberation to the consciousness of all was the understanding that this was an institutionalized mechanism of oppression in the economy and the society as a whole. And everyone is needed to fight that. And everyone has to feel that this is our movement and we're bringing something to it that is unique and precious. And the second task, and this is the other wing of this bird, is a thoroughgoing analysis of the attitudes that have been imbued in these gender expressions and getting rid of every damn one of them. This concept that masculinity is everything positive and femininity, therefore, is everything negative has to be done away with, including in our own movements. Where I hear part of the reason I wrote Stone Butch Blues was when I heard, you know, young women say, oh, you know, oh, she's so late, she's my femme. Well, you know how femmes are. I don't want to hear it.
Thank you.
You know, we shoot ourselves in the foot. If you want to defend femininity, if you want to defend femininity as being, or masculinity, let's say, as being the ability to create bookshelves that don't wobble and use power tools and change the oil on the car, well, then I am high femme. Anti-femme attitudes towards women and men are poison. They are a distillation of misogyny, and they are it's an enemy way of thinking for us all. And I, although I will claim being a masculine female for as long as it is an outlaw status, also don't want to essentialize for myself the concepts of masculinity and femininity. I think, you know, imagine only having two words to describe all of us. You know, which are you? Which are you, feminine or masculine? I mean, it's to me as though you took all of meteorological science and reduced it all to hot and cold. And who the hell would turn on television to see what the weather was going to be if they said it's going to be cold and cold and cold and cold and then it's going to be hot? How would you dress? I think of our gender expression as what each of us fashion from the social bolt of cloth that we are issued. I don't like to think about gender in terms of sharps and flats, but as the individual symphony from notes that we each make on a socially recognized tonal scale. And the reason I think this is so important to raise today is because I hear the argument that being genderqueer is more revolutionary than to be a trans man or a trans woman. And you know what? Every time I hear somebody say that transsexual men and women are upholding the binary, I look at them and it's somebody who's male or female identified. And I think, don't drag us genderqueers into your transsexual bashing. The fact is that it is an ahistorical approach to say that transsexual men and women are simply adapting to the rigid social roles for men and women today. And, you know, if we could just have a society where there was more equality and more flexibility with gender roles, then people wouldn't have to go to such extremes. And I think, wow, now there's some solidarity. I want to build a world so equitable that people like you won't exist. One of the things I did with Transgender Warriors was to go back and find every continent, thousands and thousands of years, written evidence and people's sacred stories. And you can find that what the dominant Western attitude today would refer to as sex and gender and sexuality, while it can't be applied, sex and gender and sexuality have been expressed differently in different historical periods and regions and nationalities and classes. The fact is that there's always been wide diversity in the human population. Gay American Indians in the U.S. published a book called Living the Spirit. And in the back of this book, they found the language and the words from 130 Native nations on the North American continent that had what they referred to as alternative sex/gender roles. These were pre-class societies. These were not the same societies. These are the societies that the armies of colonialism and imperialism go in and carry out a cultural genocide, a historical genocide, and are then free to say, and the way it is now is the way it has always been. So I come back to where I began. I believe that the importance is so great to us, not only in the women's liberation movement, but in the movements for liberation, to deepen our understanding of the connections between racism and national oppression and the marginalization of people based on lack of accessibility and sex and gender expression and sexuality. And our movement today, no matter where we are, is taking place in the context of this US-led war for empire. We need to be able to build diverse and powerful coalitions, but I believe they need to be united fronts, meaning that we can unite across many differences on a principled agreement, but it doesn't mean that unity means we have to leave all of who we are at the door. We don't need a movement that tolerates difference. We need a movement that is enriched by it, that does not say unity means that all women face the same oppression. that is not a contribution for unity and solidarity. We need to be able to appreciate the fact that all women don't share the same experience. And therefore, let's understand not only our difference, the different oppressions, because that's what the Stonewall Rebellion was. It was people who did not face a common oppression, who did not have the same experiences or degrees of oppression based on their leaving home in the morning, if they had a home to leave, but who made history when they united shoulder to shoulder against a common enemy. I want to bring the struggle of women to every movement, and I want to bring every struggle to women's liberation. I have heard the argument from some leftists in the U.S. that, well, you know, you can't really end the oppression of women under capitalism. And I think, thank you. I knew that. But here's my question to you. How do you think you will build unity in the class struggle if you don't fight oppression? And if we're not, as Frederick Douglass said, trying to be the best fighters against each other's oppression as the glue for that coalition. Now, when it comes to war, and I hear Laura Bush get on the radio and use the words women's liberation, it's time to sweat. It's time to get together and talk. But that's exactly what happened before the U.S. invaded Afghanistan.